You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here is producer Maureen McCollum with a story about the hunt for the state's oldest tree.
The oldest known tree in Wisconsin looks nothing like you'd expect. It's not a huge, majestic tree. In fact, it's so unremarkable that it's easy to miss. WPR's Rob Menser has been looking for this tree for years, and he brings us the story of his search.
This is the story of a hike I took and how, after years of looking, I finally found the oldest tree in Wisconsin. Maybe. Sort of.
So where am I looking?
No, you won't.
I think it could be one of those. I guess we don't know.
Okay.
When I imagined Wisconsin's oldest tree, I pictured a massive red oak with limbs the size of telephone poles. But that's not it at all. The oldest tree in Wisconsin, the oldest one we know about anyway, is a scrawny little red cedar that's growing out of the side of a cliff. I got interested in this tree about 4 years ago. I was working for a newspaper at the time, and I interviewed Douglas Larson, the scientist who discovered it in 1997. What he found was that cliffs all over the world support some of the oldest life on Earth. In Wisconsin, on a cliff formation called the Niagara Escarpment, he sampled a cedar tree that was nearly 1,300 years old. But the tree is hard to find. It's on private property in Brown County. I tried to track it down. I talked to people who had seen it, and I wrote that story for the newspaper, but I never did get to see the tree for myself.
I only learned that the tree existed a couple of years ago.
So wait, did you learn about this tree from me?
Yes, kind of. It was your article.
That's Jody Davies. She and her partner Clayton own a cannabis shop in Wrightstown.
And so I was literally asking everyone I knew that would come in, like, have you heard of this tree? Do you know where it is? Is it really here? And nobody knew.
Until one day, one of her customers said, yeah, I know where it is. I can take you out there. In September, Jody sent me a message on Facebook. Hi, Rob, she wrote. I was wondering if you ever found that tree. We're having a small field trip to go see it, and I wondered if you'd like to come along. I tried to play it cool, but yeah, I wanted to come along.
The Niagara Escarpment is actually...
At the Wrightstown Fire Station, a small group of us watched a documentary about the Niagara Escarpment.
I like to think of it as the ancient backbone of North America.
Hundreds of millions of years ago, this was the shoreline of a prehistoric lake. The same cliffs that create Niagara Falls in upstate New York wind through Wisconsin. Dennis Bining, whose house is at the bottom of the ledge, had gotten permission to bring the group of us on a hike to see the tree. The problem was, he told Jody, we couldn't get that close.
We had that tornado come through in 2013.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why it's going to be tough to get to the base of the ledge because of the devastation.
The other problem was the cliffs are hundreds of feet high. We got as close as we could to the tree, but it was still pretty far away. Dennis let us look through his binoculars, but if I'm honest, I wasn't 100% sure which tree growing out of the side of the cliff was the tree.
Did you get closer when you did your story?
No.
I didn't get this close, no.
Gotcha.
I drove
gotcha.
Down that road.
And that was it. That was as close as we got. On the walk back, we tried to convince ourselves that we'd accomplished the mission.
Very cool.
I mean, we saw it.
We did see it. We aren't sure exactly which one.
Yeah.
But our eyes saw it.
Why can a scrubby little cedar tree growing from the side of a cliff live for 1,300 years? The face of a cliff is a terrible place to grow. It doesn't get good water, it doesn't have rich soil. But here's the secret. When you're growing from a cliff, no one bothers you. Most of the time, people can't even find you. But we did find the tree. We did get to see it. You know, probably.
WPR's Rob Menser brought us that story on Wisconsin's oldest tree. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now, as the U.S. Supreme Court appears poised to return abortion regulation to the states, we look at what reproductive health care access could look like in a post-Roe Wisconsin. Join in on reproductive health, on access to birth control, on how miscarriages are managed. 800-642-1234. Jenny Higgins is a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at UW-Madison. She directs the OBGYN Division of Reproductive and Population Health and leads the UW Center for Reproductive Equity. That's a reproductive healthcare research initiative. Jenny, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. I appreciate you paying attention to this really important issue.
What went through your mind when you first read the leaked draft opinion? What stood out to you?
It was a moment that was both expected and stunning. I think the fact that the decision was as stridently worded as it was, leaving open a variety of other sorts of cases to emerge, was really stunning. On the other hand, those of us working in the abortion research field have been anticipating this moment for quite some time. So it's also the culmination of a whole bunch of things leading up to this moment and something we were expecting.
What about the response of the nation, the protests, the demonstrations that you've seen across cities, and what do you make of the reaction to the draft?
I'm not surprised. I think that abortion is an incredibly important litmus test in our country and our political landscape for a variety of things. And I also think that few people may have actually realized how threatened legal abortion was. And I think we've seen glimpses of that with recent bills that were passed in Texas and Oklahoma and Ohio and Mississippi and Louisiana, showing a weakening of abortion access. But I think Roe was really a moment of reckoning for people around it. And I'll say, I think folks also perhaps were out of the loop around how abortion's legality does not equate with accessibility, right? So in places like Wisconsin and all across the country, just because abortion is legal, and even when healthcare clinics exist, there are a number of people who can't access services because of financial constraints, because of distance, because of a variety of other factors.
And I want to probe that a little further, because President Biden last week said this is about a lot more than abortion. Can you explain some of that ripple effect of overturning Roe and ending the constitutional right to an abortion? What are the ramifications there on other things?
It's a great question, and I will talk to you about abortion research all day long. I'm not a policy expert here, so I want to defer to some of my policy colleagues to give you a really in-depth answer around that. But I think that the overturning or the significant weakening of Roe v. Wade, especially the way the decision was worded, leaves open a variety of other issues that we have been considering set in stone, but might not be, right? So we've seen declines in contraceptive services, public funding for contraceptive services over many years, and those declines may be likely to increase, as well as potentially different contraceptive methods in certain states being potentially threatened or prohibited in light of certain abortion bans. So while I'm not exactly sure what will unfold from a policy perspective on those other issues, the direction certainly doesn't look to be in the direction of supporting people's ability to have the families they want to have, feel supported in that, be able to prevent and or prevent pregnancies and or seek abortions as they need and desire.
From the research you do, you found 91% of physicians believe women's health care would worsen if Roe is overturned. How could women's health care worsen without this the national abortion protections under Roe?
Yeah, it's a great question. And just to lift up that study, our survey was of over 900 doctors at our state's largest medical school and our only public medical school. So these were 900 doctors across medical specialties, and more than 90% said that women's health care in Wisconsin would get worse if Roe v. Wade were overturned. So abortion is often seen as an important outcome by itself, as an important indicator of reproductive autonomy. However, abortion is also a determinant of health and well-being across the life course. So let me give you a few examples of this. One is we have excellent research showing that compared to people who were able to access desired abortion services, people denied desired abortion services and then who go on to give birth are more likely to stay in abusive relationships. They're less likely to be able to achieve aspirational life goals. They're less likely to complete post-secondary education, more likely to experience persistent adverse economic consequences, right? So we know that there are negative impacts on health and well-being. We also have evidence that abortion restrictions contribute to increased maternal mortality, especially among Black communities and other structurally oppressed communities. And we're strongly anticipating a rise in maternal morbidity and mortality if and when abortion is outlawed or made completely inaccessible in a state like Wisconsin. And some people hear this figure and think, oh, that's because of the potential for unsafe abortions. And that's not it at all. The increase in morbidity and mortality will come about because inherently carrying pregnancies to term and giving birth are more risky than first trimester abortion. So giving birth from an adverse event perspective is 14 times as likely to end in death than a first trimester abortion. So that's another impact on people in Wisconsin if they are not able to access desired abortion services.
We have UW Reproductive Equity Scholar, head of the UW Division of Reproductive and Population Health. Jenny Higgins here stays with us on the ripple effect on reproductive health care if the High Court overturns Roe. Join in on what could be an entirely different landscape for reproductive health, what you see ahead, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Jenny Higgins here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kedar Chirkent. Let's get back to our conversation now at the intersection of reproductive health care. What happens if the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade? The Guttmacher Institute, that's the research group focused on reproductive health, it says if Roe falls, 26 states are certain or likely to ban abortions. That includes Wisconsin. Still time to discuss, 800-642-1234. Jenny Higgins is a UW-Madison professor of obstetrics and gynecology, directs its Center for Reproductive Equity, former board of directors, vice chair of the Guttmacher Institute, stays with us. Let's bring in Ron now in Pioneer, Missouri. Ron, hi. What would you like to add?
We need a moderate policy which 80% of the U.S. population, the 80% in the middle, will tolerate, not necessarily like, but tolerate. And so my question is concerning the U.S. population in 2021, before the current controversy, what percent of the population rejected the status quo on abortion? What percent rejected it because they are pro-life? What percent rejected the policies because they're pro-choice? You know, is the current policy in the middle, or is it skewed to life or choice?
Ron, thank you for that question. Jenny, what does the research tell you?
The research tells us that the majority of people in the U.S. do not feel that Roe should be overturned. The majority of U.S. citizens feel as if Roe should be left in place. As researchers, we have sometimes struggled with the questions used in polling around abortion. There's a really robust literature showing that what we think we're capturing when we ask people about their attitudes about abortion aren't actually accurate. When we phrase questions in our research along the lines of, to what extent do you agree that a pregnant person should be able to decide in consultation with her doctor about whether and how to either terminate a pregnancy or carry a pregnancy to term, the overwhelming majority of people agree with that statement. So this Supreme Court decision does not, if it, in fact it overturns Roe, does not represent the majority of Americans' opinions on this issue.
So language, what you're saying, really matters. You also found an overwhelming majority of respondents have concerns about the doctor-patient relationship. What are you finding there?
Yeah, our research suggests that physicians are quite concerned about the ways in which about legislative interference into their practice. And abortion is an interesting and perhaps exceptional example of how people without healthcare training experience are determining the ways in which healthcare services are offered or not. And so I think physicians are quite concerned about that trend in addition to the consequences of that trend on patients.
You mentioned earlier unsanctioned abortions. What are the risks there, the medical risks?
Sure. So let me first say that when people cannot access abortion in their own states, they'll do one of three things. They will either cross state lines into what we call haven states, where abortion access will be protected regardless of Roe status. But of course, many people will be unable to do so. And we have evidence that many people currently can't get abortion services within their state, even when it's legal, because of a bunch of barriers. A second thing that will happen to people is that they won't be able to get abortions at all and will be forced to carry pregnancies to term. And then the third option is that people will self-manage their abortions. And when self-management means working outside the formal healthcare system without clinical consultation to perform an abortion on oneself. And the options for self-managed abortions are very different now than they were around the time that Roe v. Wade was passed. So there are FDA-approved medications called misoprostol and mifepristone that are currently used for medication abortion care in the U.S. They cause miscarriages to occur. These pills are available through non-standard healthcare centers. So mail order services, for example. And so we expect that people will turn more and more to these services. We're already seeing evidence that with Texas's 6-week ban, the increase in orders to one particular medication abortion service called Aid Access increased. We also know during COVID that orders to Aid Access increased, suggesting that people are already self-managing their abortions due to difficult access.
We're talking with Jenny Higgins, professor of obstetrics and gynecology at UW-Madison. Jenny, how would a ban on abortions complicate care around miscarriages?
It's a great question. So we certainly, from a research perspective, from a clinical perspective, are expecting more people to show up in emergency rooms or primary healthcare centers with miscarriages in process. Now, care providers cannot discern whether a miscarriage started naturally or was induced through medication. There's just no way for a healthcare provider to tell that. So we are hoping and expecting that we can prepare healthcare providers to be equipped with tools to help with miscarriage management, which often are just needing care around excessive bleeding. So we are really hoping that that happens. We have a number of Catholic-owned healthcare systems in Wisconsin and in many other states. And at Catholic-owned healthcare facilities, something called the ethical and religious directives determine and shape the type of care that can be offered at those facilities. And miscarriage management goes against the directives because it, in some ways, is against God's will or against the natural experience of someone having a miscarriage. Mm-hmm. So we're concerned from a research and clinical perspective that in places in Wisconsin and elsewhere where a Catholic-owned hospital is the only accessible hospital in the county, that folks might get turned away from necessary miscarriage management care.
Or perhaps even the physician, you know, if there is an abortion ban, the physician might be apprehensive to provide intervention or have to do a lot more documentation, I would imagine.
It's an excellent point. I think the law will be very confusing to people about exactly who might be committing a felony and when from a provider perspective. So even though helping someone manage a miscarriage would not at all be going against the potential abortion ban that would be put in place in Wisconsin and elsewhere, physicians may absolutely be concerned about that and be hesitant to provide that care. So I think education is really important.
In our last moments together, how might this ban inform the research you do going forward?
We are trying as a research organization to think about how we document the impacts of this ban on people in our state and elsewhere. So it's absolutely certain that the number of abortions in Wisconsin will decrease dramatically, if not stop altogether. So while we want to track those numbers and track the numbers of people in our state who cross state lines to get their services, we also are looking to recruit Wisconsinites into studies where we could follow them over time about what their experiences are if they were either able to obtain desired abortions or if they weren't, and what happens to the latter group as a result, and what happens to the latter group's children and families as a result.
Jenny, thank you for joining us.
I appreciate, again, your attention to this issue. Thanks so much.
Jenny Higgins is a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at UW-Madison, directs the OBGYN Division of Reproductive and Population Health. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.